on advanced buffer overruns. He'd coded up, he'd reverse engineered and coded up a unique buffer overrun as an example of how it's possible without having source access to still find buffer overruns in commented or uncommented source code. And while he's talking along, he kind of slips in a brand new vulnerability that people had talked about, but it, as far as I know, hasn't been published on BugTrack or even really written about. And it was sort of this transition from ring 3 to ring 0 in Windows NT, from user space into kernel space, and which shouldn't be able to happen. It sort of breaks the whole NT model of security. And then he just moved on and talked about some other stuff. And so we said, well, why don't you come back and talk maybe about this a little bit more in depth and talk about finding these overflows. So Joey's come over to hang out in Vegas for the week and give you this presentation, which has not been heard before. So let's welcome Joey.
All right, thanks guys. And as Jeff already introduced, my name is Joey. And today I would like to sort of like carry on from where I left in Singapore and talk more about how we can take or what technologies that which would let us take the exploits from user land into kernel mode. And the main reason why I would like to talk about that is that I think everybody is familiar and everybody knows like how bad it is to get owned. But it's not exactly appreciated how badly you can get owned or like to which level the impact can be, especially like, excuse me. Especially under Windows NT, when you look at all the existing exploits which are out there, they are more or less along the lines of either running some program or spawning a command shell or doing something which is limited to a user mode process. And today my focus would be to take you through sort of like an overview or chronology of how these things came about and where we have gone and what information we have for the time being, and talk about how or what cool or uncool stuff is being done through remote or local exploits in NT and 2K, and talk about taking it to the next level, which is like to take it into Ring Zero and actually own the trusted computing base itself. And the reasons why people would do it and how possibly they can do it and how we might want to prevent it or how we would want to respond to it. But this talk is not going to be about a super cool silver bullet exploit that will like crack NT. That's not what it's all about. It's about the impact of being owned. So having said that, let's carry on. And well, as this slide explains, we are looking at a situation where we assume that an intruder has already gained administrative or higher level privileges, for example, like system context or administrative privileges on your machine, either through, for example, like a remote buffer overflow or either to some kind of misconfiguration in a program, or for example, this is one example I would like to give which hasn't been greatly looked at. Like most Microsoft transaction server components, if you really look at them, they run in the system context, and I have come across a couple of third-party applications which have configurable COM objects which actually read the registry and instantiate other components. For example, like a plugin model, where other third-party applications can actually come and register their interfaces, and the main MTS component will instantiate those interfaces with through their proper operation. But the thing is, there is no authentication between the actual application provider's component architecture and the third-party plugins. So technically, if anybody can just register a plugin in the system, these guys will run it under the system context, which is what their components are running under. So in that kind of situation, an attacker can elevate their privileges into the system context like really easily. And that gives him a lot of potential, because there are certain operating system features of Windows NT or 2000, which is not by default even given to the administrator. But when you get to local system context, that is the security context of the trusted computing base, you can technically do anything you want to do. And it is scary how easily you can do this. So, for example, our playing field will be an environment where a system has already been infiltrated and the intruder has the ability to run malicious code on the system, either at the security context of the administrator or local system. Well, I mean, it's not as difficult to get local system security context from the administrator itself, because I mean it can be very simple. It can be just as simple as getting your malicious code and scheduling it through the AT service to run at a specific time, and it'll run as a local system. So the assumption is that you have elevated privileges and you can run malicious code in that system at that elevated privilege. Okay, as security researchers, systems administrators, or anybody who really does give a damn about their systems, this is what we're trying to achieve here. First, we need to understand the nature of security vulnerabilities that would allow arbitrary code execution. Now, I mean, I can remember back in even in 98, I can remember people saying like, oh, buffer overflows, that doesn't happen in NT, that doesn't happen in 2K. And these are like the people who were responsible for major server application development. And even today, with a lot of awareness, still some people don't realize that buffer overflows and format string exploits and things like that are actually possible under NT and 2K. So our first task is to actually understand the fact that we can have exploits which can very easily execute malicious code under Windows NT and 2000 systems. But I mean, today for the most part, through the hard work and pain of a lot of people and a lot of good research, people do realize that for the most part. But the second step is to actually understand what technologies a person with malicious intent can use once he has the ability to actually either remotely or locally execute malicious code at elevated privileges. Now, understanding technology is very important, because if we are to address the impact on the system, the potential impact on the system through these exploits, we have to understand what technologies or what class of technologies are at the disposal of the attacker and what he can use. So it is very important that we understand these technologies so that we can have a clearer idea of what they can potentially do. And there are certain products out there, and there are certain products that are actually coming up, which take a broad look at these technologies and try to think of innovative ways to attack or prevent the use of these technologies under a specific set of circumstances that might be used in this kind of exploit situation. And of course, after that, I mean, once we know what technologies these guys can use, the next step is to actually go on and see what can be actually achieved through this, through the use of these technologies. Now, we understand that from programming perspective that almost anything can be done on any system, provided that you have enough security privileges and the technology to do that. But in an exploit scenario where there's a lot of restrictions and a lot of like unwritten rules that you have to live by or abide by, the full potential of these technologies cannot be utilized to their full capacity, because I mean you had to work within certain limitations, not like writing a standard user mode or kernel mode application. So in understanding and responding to these threats, we need to understand using these technologies what exactly they can do and what exactly they can't do. Now, in a user mode environment where like a lot of exploits do actually operate in right now, the impact is somewhat, well, I wouldn't say minimal, but it's somewhat manageable, either through better awareness or better monitoring of your systems or through specialized software. It is better manageable than in situations which I would discuss later. Excuse me. And once we understand all this and once we realize how much of a threat this actually is, I think our goal here is to make sure that we can respond properly to a threat of this kind. And as software vendors and researchers, we can go out and explore new technologies that would make this kind of attacks more difficult, or, well, I wouldn't say impossible, but more difficult, actually, sort of like raise the bar higher than where it is right now. For example, these malicious code execution scenarios, I would like to take a Win32 buffer overflow, which is like the one of the simplest, most widely known, and one of the most straightforward ways of getting malicious code to execute in elevator privileges. And just to give a background and for further education, I would like to point out some resources which are out there. First, I would like to point out Alifan's excellent article in FRAC about what was titled Smashing the Stack for Fun and Profit. I think it was one of the pioneering articles, if I'm not mistaken. And then afterwards, I think this was like, Alifan's article was pretty much generic. And after that, I think Solar Designer did a lot of work on Win32 exploits and overflows, and I think he published a few of them, but to my knowledge it hasn't been like widely publicized, or at least not many people have seen it. But if I can remember right, it was he published a CGI overflow which would actually download a file and execute it. So as far as I can remember, that was one of the very first work. And that should be available on Usenet. So if you search for Solar Designer and buffer overflow, you'll probably come across it. And then there was Dildog's text, which was called The Tower of Windows Buffer Overflow. And I think it was more of a heap overflow, which I can't remember, but it was very good reading text as well. And then Barnaby Jack published his inspirational article on FRAC about how to reverse engineer and write an actual exploit, sort of like putting everything together. So like you take an application, you reverse engineer it, this is how you find the holes and this is how you exploit it. And Greg Hogland has been doing a great job talking about the technologies behind actually exploiting buffer overflow vulnerabilities, and I think most of you might have been present at his talk yesterday, and he did a great talk in Singapore as well. And then I did a piece on buffer overflows in Singapore as well. And the presentation should be available online. So first, let's take a look at basically the payload that has been delivered so far through Win32 exploits. Like initially, the first one was, I think, I saw it in Solar Designer's work, if I remember right. What it did was it exploited a CGI executable, and it let you upload a file into the script directory and then execute it via HTTP. So the sole purpose of the exploit was to actually let a file, get a file to be uploaded and write it to the file system. And you would just do an HTTP query, and since it is in a executable directory, which has executable permissions, you can execute it through the web. So that actual executable can contain any of your secondary payload, for example, like whatever you want to do, like even Trojanize the system or whatever. And then there was a kind of interesting and unique exploit which was written a while back again, which actually enabled the disabled guest account and changed its password and added it to the administrative group all through a remote exploit. And then, of course, we saw code that would actually download a Trojan executable and actually execute it through the exploit itself. And there was code which would actually download Netcat and bind it to a port so you can actually have a command shell. And then we moved on, and I think Barnaby Jack showed some excellent code in his Frack article where he would actually, without downloading anything, he would actually spawn command cmd.exe and bind a command shell to a TCP port. And after that, of course, there was the reverse command shell. Now, I would like to take a few minutes and actually look at this reverse command shell a little bit deeper, because personally, I think it's not been appreciated much. It has been around, but the advantages of it has not been really realized, so to speak. Now, in a situation where you have firewalls or route access control lists protecting certain entities within your network, a lot of buffer overflow vulnerabilities and exploits which are remote, which would actually give the attacker a chance to further exploit, would, for the most part, I mean, would fail, because, for example, if, like in the previous, what I previously went through, for example, if they use payload which would actually enable the guest account and add it to the administrative group, if your firewall doesn't allow any net bias traffic, it wouldn't do any good. Or even if all incoming connections are restricted except for certain services, certain legitimate services which are running on the host, even binding a port and actually spawning a command shell once somebody connects wouldn't work at all, because nobody would be able to connect through the firewall or the router. Now, the interesting thing about the reverse shell is that it actually lets the attacker to get the host to connect back to the attacker's machine. So in most situations, what I have seen in the enterprise is that incoming connections are restricted to these hosts based on whatever the ports there are, which are running legitimate services. But for the most part, outgoing connections are unsanctioned. So in this kind of scenario, a reverse command shell is very, very, very advantageous, because it would just let the, it would just make the attacker like listen on one of his ports. And once the exploit code is run, it will come and connect back to him and give him a command shell. Through that, he can continue whatever he wants to continue. And most network-based and host-based intrusion detection systems only think about incoming connections. Like most intrusion detection systems which are host-based has rules like, which say, okay, allow only 10 telnet connections for this host for this session, or allow only one telnet connection through this application or whatever. So there's a lot of focus on incoming traffic, but for outgoing traffic, it is unsanctioned for the most part, and most intrusion detection systems are not even concerned about basically the outgoing traffic, because it's monitoring only incoming traffic for suspicious activities, anomalies, known exploits, and things like that. So even in that sense, the reverse command shell is advantageous because the host is actually going out and connecting outside. And the other thing is that the actual initial attack process and subsequent exploits which are conducted through the exploitation is sort of decoupled, so that you don't have to actually do it from the same machine. So the initial exploitation process can be sort of indirectly performed if necessary. Like for an example, if I do not have access to a server through a firewall, and then, I mean, there's nothing I can do because I can't connect and exploit the service at all. But imagine a situation where there's a malicious attacker, and there's this host which the malicious attacker can't reach, but there is another machine on that network which can actually access that service, and that machine is used for something like checking mail. So for example, someone can use an exploit in the Outlook, send a mail, Outlook gets exploited, boom, and that will actually mount an attack against the host because he can access it, and then the host will connect back to the hacker's machine and say, hey, we are done. So you can, since the initial attack process and the subsequent exploitation is actually decoupled, people can have indirect techniques to actually perform the initial exploitation, and after that, since the host is coming connecting back to you, you know that it's been exploited, and you can go ahead and do whatever the malicious intent that they have in mind. So the reverse command shell is quite powerful in that sense, and so we need to understand this, and we have to, wherever possible, have some kind of emphasis in the outgoing connections as well as the incoming traffic connections, because in this kind of scenario, whatever the sanctions or whatever the monitoring performed on incoming traffic wouldn't make much sense. And then, of course, there's always a situation in buffer overflow vulnerabilities that you are limited to a certain size restriction of malicious code that you can execute. So whatever you do has to be done in a certain way that the code is not too large. I mean, there's nothing much you can do. I guess that's that was one of the main reasons why the spawning of a command shell was actually being pursued at the time, because from an initial exploit, there was nothing much you can do. I mean, maybe download a file, execute something, but to have further control and to continue the further exploitation, it was necessary that you do something else which would give you control and which would let you maintain the control. So the command shell spawning process would actually give you that. Now, the problem with command shell spawning process, as far as the exploits I have seen so far, is that if you rename your command interpreter, most of these exploits will be broken. So the attacker would actually have to brute force the new name of your command shell executable as well. And since to actually perform the functionality of a command shell requires a significant amount of code, it is not likely that in most cases that all that functionality will be coded into the exploit itself. But, well, I mean, needless to say that there will be a new wave of exploits to actually address that situation as well, where the attacker can actually download the command shell from the attacker's machine and execute it there. So, I mean, it's not a solution, but it will raise the bar against most of the script kiddies out there who are using existing exploits to break into other machines. Because all these exploits, for the time being, what I have seen, spawn a command shell. Now, this double payload, what I'm talking about here, is actually I think the double payload is the wrong word because it can be multi-tier payload. What happens is that in the most restrictive situations, you write small shellcode, which would actually do nothing except fetch some larger or more complicated and sophisticated shellcode from variable location and prepare an execution environment for it within the current process or a different process address space, and then fetch the code and put it there, relocate it, and execute it. And the second tier code can be, since you are fetching it, there won't be any restrictions as to the size, or there won't be any restrictions as to what kind of character set the code can comprise of, and things like nulls in the strings or whatever. I mean, those problems won't be there at all because you are fetching this code. So what you have is that you address the situation with very restrictive code which only does the simple task of allocating an execution environment, fetching the second tier of payload, relocating it, and executing it from there. So if you look at it in a user mode perspective, the potential of this technique is quite high because you can virtually do anything. And there are public exploits which actually use this technique. And the one exploit was used in a situation where the initial exploitation was a 250-byte buffer, which was fragmented as well. So there's nothing much you could do with it. But the second tier exploit code could be all the way up to 64K. And once you have 64K of malicious code executed in there, you can pretty much do anything. I mean, you can mount even a third layer of attack where you can fetch more complicated code and execute it. So this kind of cascading code, which actually after the initial exploitation, which is performed with a very small payload, can be, the power can be elevated to great extents from a user mode perspective, at least for the time being. And then there is a recycling payload which can be used in the most restrictive environments. Now, when I was explaining the reverse shellcode, I was saying that since there are no sanctions on outgoing traffic, it is very feasible to use it. Now, what if there was, for example, sanctions on outgoing traffic as well? Say that I have a web server, and I have configured my firewalls and route access lists, so then it can only take incoming TCP connections, and that's it. It can't connect anywhere on its own, or no other services can be reached through the firewall or the route access list. So in that kind of situation, even reverse shellcode won't work because it can't actually create a connection to the outside. So in that kind of situations, what would you do? Let's take a typical example of a web server or even a CGI script. When you take the web server, you actually, for example, let's take IIS and ISAP server extension. In an ISAP API server extension, when you first create a connection and pass a request, the ISAP DLL gets control and the socket is still kept open, and the ISAP DLL is passed a socket handle if it needs to do further network communication over that same handle. So if someone was to actually go out and exploit an ISAP DLL, all that person has to do is actually read the structure which is passed to the ISAP DLL by IIS, and you can get a hold of a function pointer table which would let you actually read and write over the same network connection. And even if it's not an ISAP DLL or it's a standard CGI, and in most cases, most web servers don't terminate the connection without a certain period of time. Basically, it waits till the script to timeout, and after that only terminates the connection. So once you exploit that program, you can scan in the web server's memory, or you can hard code in web server's memory where the actual socket handle for this network communication resides. And through your exploit, you can use the same network communication, basically like the socket handle, and you can do whatever the rest you want to do through the exact same network communication channel which has already been established in a legitimate manner. So the implications are that even in the strictest environment where you can't have any outgoing connections, since you're using the established legitimate connection, you can still perform whatever the task you have, you want to perform. And coupled with that, and the cascading shellcode techniques, there's a lot of impact from the network point of view, because that kind of attack would be extremely difficult or even impossible to stop from a network point of view and access list point of view. And the potential that it offers for larger and larger code to be executed on the system in a systematic way opens like a new door to performing a lot of complicated functions, which is unprecedented in certain Win32 exploitation situations because of the shellcode limitations. Now, having looked at all these techniques, one common thing all these techniques have is that they exclusively deal with user mode. Basically, they perform whatever the functions they perform in the context of a user address space application. So, since a user address space application is not powerful enough to have significant impact on the key operating system functionality itself, the products which are actually developed to either look for this kind of inconsistencies or prevent this kind of inconsistencies, they are very successful in both cases and in detection as well, because the functions that are performed in user mode can be very easily traced, detected, and acted upon. I mean, there are already products out there which does this sort of thing. Now, for example, like CyberCop Monitor, which is an intrusion detection system and which is host-based, does a lot of this kind of monitoring, like monitoring for suspicious activity. And there's Tripwire, of course, which looks for like file system and system inconsistencies. And I think JD Glazer did some excellent work in Windows NT and Win2K forensics. And that URL should still contain most of the tools that he has used. Using tools and technologies like this, it is very easy to detect, assess, and manage and even counteract this kind of user mode exploitation process. Because the other programs, which the tools we use, can work with the operating system to detect this kind of activity. And since the malicious code does not do anything against the operating system's functionality, they are very easily detected in that sense. I mean, their stealthiness is very low. So the next wave of exploits, what we are probably going to see, will have a lot of things to do with the actual operating system. And the situation is that since most of these exploits already have enough privileges to actually go and severely affect the operating system's functionality, it's just a matter of time before a new wave of Win32 exploits are going to appear. Or rather, I wouldn't say Win32 exploits, because that would be wrong. Windows NT and Windows 2000 exploits will appear, which would go out and either disable, modify, or even in some cases enhance the operating system functionality to suit the malicious needs or malicious intent of the exploitation code. Now, if we look at why exactly an exploit or malicious code would want to violate the trusted computing base and violate the key operational functionalities of the operating system itself, well, first of all, it's about stealth. It's about owning a system and living there, not being detected. So to maintain the ownership of the own system, it is necessary that you maintain the maximum stealth. In order to do that, and in order to work against the products which are already installed on the system or would be used by an administrator to detect and attack this kind of behavior. One might want to actually go into the trusted computing base. And let's look at a wider scenario where somebody exploits the system for malicious information gathering purposes. In that kind of situation, what the amount of information you can gather as a user mode process is a lot, but it's limited to a certain extent. And if you are looking at like some advanced spying capability, which is system-wide, for example, like if an intruder wants to say analyze every single program you are running and look for valuable information within those programs in a sort of generic fashion, it's very difficult to do from user mode program. Or, for example, if that person wants to have advanced keyboard capturing functionality, say to do it in a fashion where it would be a lot more reliable and it would be undetectable. Say, for example, actually patch the keyboard driver and look at all the keyboard codes, and every time a key is pressed, you can see which thread's message queue these keys are going to, and then you can check the Win32 status of that application and possibly deduce whether it is going to, for example, a password box. To do this kind of advanced stuff, a user mode program is most of the time insufficient. So that is another reason why malicious code which is running on an exploited system would want to violate the trusted computing base. And the other one would be to introduce subtle but malicious changes to the functionality of the operating system. Say, for example, like if someone wants to corrupt the status of an existing database over time to make sure that every single record that is written to the database is corrupted in some form, or files written to the file system is corrupted in some form, or maybe it is encrypted, made a copy somewhere else for every application. To do that kind of subtle but powerful changes to the overall functionality of a system, regardless of which processes we are talking about here, an exploit might want to actually get into the trusted computing base. And the other one is that if you look at it from a host-based point of view, I mean, there are a lot of personal firewalls out there. There are a lot of other applications which look for like which applications are communicating or which ports and stuff like that. So if actually user mode process opens a connection to the outside or there's some form of network interaction through user mode, it'll be very easy to detect. So what if that same thing can be done in a totally undetectable level from host point of view? I mean, of course, one can argue that over the network you can look for suspicious activity. I mean, that's just the way it is, but from a host-based point of view, like for example, if I'm using a personal firewall and I have set a rule saying that only these programs can communicate through these ports and to these addresses, and if the attacker wants to bypass that, just using the user mode APIs won't work. And if it is a well-written TDI-based personal firewall, doing direct TDIs won't work either. So a person might actually resort to actually hooking the TCP/IP.sys, which is a NT or Win2K TCP/IP stack, and use the internal routines there itself to implement your covert network operation channels. Like for example, I've seen a covert communication channel implemented to ICMP on Windows 2000. What it does is it actually hooks a certain function which gets called every time an ICMP packet is reached. The system receives an ICMP packet, and the actual packet contents are like given to this function. So if a malicious program was to actually hook this function and take a look at the actual code or the actual commands or whatever is sent over the network in that ICMP packet, it can implement its command channel through that and discard whatever the package which it's using and not let the operating system see whatever it's using. So the main idea here is that almost all the tools out there which are supposed to prevent or make it more difficult for this kind of exploitation is actually using the functionality of the operating system for its usage. It is relying on the operating system and is relying on the integrity and the trust it has placed on the operating system for its functionality. It's like they want to catch the bad guys, but they still do trust the operating system, and without the operating system, they can't catch the bad guys. So what the bad guys want to do is actually go and change the operating system so that operating system would either lie or destroy these programs which are actually supposed to catch the bad guys. So from a security research point of view, these protective applications should, and some are actually approaching this problem and trying to look into ways how they can deal with this kind of manipulation with the operating system. It has already been demonstrated how things like tripwire can be very easily subverted through this kind of operating system manipulation. And like I was explaining, it's very simple to do host, at least in a host-based situation, undetectable network traffic. So I mean, those are the reasons why people will want to take the exploitation to the next level and take it from user mode into the Ring Zero kernel itself, and it'll be very, very hard to detect, and it'll be very, very hard to actually counter that against unless you really understand what these technologies are all about and how these things can be done. The key here is to understand what kind of technologies would offer these exploits to inject itself or become a part of the trusted computing base in order to violate it. Now, I would like to take as an example of what has been done already in this area. Mostly, the standard technique for this kind of kernel mode interaction is the use of a kernel mode driver. And for the most part, this is the only technique people know about on how to load code into the kernel. Now, there has been a lot of work done in this area as well, as far as using the kernel mode driver model and exploiting the trusted computing base to the point where it's very easily demonstrable that these are the impacts of this kind of attacks. So I think Greg did a great paper on this in FRAC, and in there he patched SE access check, which is a kernel mode function of the security reference monitor. And what it did was like a 2-byte patch, and it gave all access to all objects by everybody. And once the kernel is violated like that, none of the access permissions on an NT or even 2K system would matter at all. So if you have like auditing on a file system for denied access, that won't get you anywhere because all access will be granted regardless. And how many people would actually look at the memory image of their kernel and see like, has somebody actually written to this? That stuff doesn't happen in real world. So this is a threat we really need to address, because, I mean, okay, people now look at certain ports and say, hey, maybe I'm Trojanized, but how many people actually look at their kernel? I mean, how people actually now look at loading device drivers. I mean, okay, there is trusted device drivers and device driver signing and all that, so that there is a like a more slightly more secure way of like loading device drivers. I mean, administrators just won't load any device driver anymore, I hope. At least they will look for a signed device driver which is trusted. So we are getting somewhere, but when it comes to actual kernel exploitation, people just don't look at it. And I'm sure like most of the people who are involved in like computer forensics as well, I don't know whether they actually look at this stuff. Because now, so for example, Tripwire. If Tripwire was to look at the system's integrity, and what if the OS lies to Tripwire saying that, hey, the file system is okay, nobody touched it, you're doing fine. And Tripwire wouldn't like actually give any alarm. And I know that it has been done in Solaris where they have, I think, demonstrated how Tripwire can be subverted, and this has been done in NTI as well. But unfortunately, it's not public information. So this has been done against a couple of other intrusion detection systems as well. And so this stuff is definitely out there. So we need to realize that this stuff is out there and people do these things. So we need to counteract against it. But the problem here is that it is a very challenging area. It is a very challenging task to address all these issues because it's a new area for most. And for most products which are actually relying for this kind of functionality from the OS itself, it's a shift in paradigm to actually say, like, hey, to hell with the US, to hell with the OS, I want to do things my way. And the technical details involved in the process is also very difficult. And even from a software development point of view, to manage that kind of a complex application which does so many sort of non-standard or non-Microsoft approved interactions with the operating system is a big task. But in light of all these exploits and before the new wave of public exploits are going to hit us, which are using these techniques, it is absolutely necessary that we understand this, the impact of these things, and try to address it. Now, the actual kernel mode injection techniques beyond loading a kernel mode driver, I want to discuss these things, but the only thing is that this is like extremely technical, and a lot of source code demonstrations would help, but unfortunately, most of the work which we have done in this area remain proprietary. So it is not exactly easy to go out and demonstrate these techniques and explain these techniques because, okay, maybe not many people are aware of this, but kernel mode driver is not, I should actually mention this first, but a kernel mode driver is not the only way to inject code into Ring Zero in Windows NT and Windows 2000. And this has been a known fact for the last 5 years at least. So monitoring against or protecting from kernel mode drivers is not the end to this kind of problems. And if you are bug track readers, I think there was a recent thread to which Greg Hoglund contributed quite a lot about the never-ending chess game when it comes to this area. So as far as the actual technologies, I would like to point out three. One is a kernel mode buffer overflow. I've seen enough third-party applications which has their kernel mode components which are vulnerable to buffer overflows. And for the most part, for the time being, for the most part, these vulnerabilities are not really exploited because the main reason is that Win32 overflow technology won't work in Ring Zero. So for the most part, what it'll amount is a local denial of service when you're the administrator. So how difficult is that? So I would like to actually go over that technology as well. Now, the difficulty there is actually explaining these concepts and technologies in a fashion where I can actually explain it at a talk without using much code or demonstration programs. So maybe I'll try that when I move on to the deep knowledge track. Or maybe we should have a technical breakout session where I would take questions and answer questions to anybody who's interested in this area. But as I was saying earlier, I would point out the three techniques, or rather some of the techniques out there which can be used to load malicious code into kernel mode without actually using device drivers. Like I said earlier, one is like buffer overflow situations in third-party or operating system kernel mode trusted components. And the second is that Windows 2000 and Windows NT has a certain kernel mode session object which is created when the memory manager is initialized, called device/physical memory. And this section is like, okay, kernel, if you are not familiar, kernel mode sections are the kernel mode counterpart of what in the Win32 world which we know as file mappings or file mapping objects. There are two ways to actually create a section object, where a section object can either be backed up by a physical, or rather an existing file in the file system, or the system virtual memory. Now the uniqueness of this device physical memory is that the memory manager creates it, and it backs it up neither by virtual memory nor a file system file, but the physical memory of the system. So why is this used? This is used by the operating system for its internal functionality, where operating system requires the access to physical memory. One scenario is when your graphics driver is being initialized. Your graphics driver needs to read its parameter information from the PC address space, basically, which is memory mapped, of course. So to read that, this needs to access physical memory. So the operating system would use the device/physical memory to access that information. And the other thing is in 16-bit programs, when you're using a DOS virtual machine, certain physical memory areas have to be consistent within the virtual machine address space as well. So the kernel uses the device physical memory section to actually read that information from physical memory and map it to the V86 environment where the 16-bit process is running in. So this is the reason why device physical memory exists. It's not because Microsoft wanted to install backdoor. And if you take off the access to device physical memory, you will break these parts of the operating system, plus perhaps legitimate programs which will use it. But to date, I haven't come across any program either from Microsoft or otherwise which actually uses device physical memory, except for when it's being used in the kernel in these areas I discussed earlier. And the second is in VW's set system information, which is a native API call used to set or query various operating system parameters. This can actually be used to load an image into the kernel address space and execute it. What happens is this function has an information class called system load and call image. Well, there is system load image and system unload image as well, but these can only be used in ring zero itself, which can be used by a device driver or like a kernel mode component to actually load an image to make the process easier. But the system load and call image would actually load any portable executable image into the kernel, create a ring zero thread and execute it. And it'll execute it in the same process context of whatever the process which calls this function. So that technique can be utilized to inject code into ring zero. So having said that, I think I've gone a little bit over my time on this one. I think I'll be moving to the deep knowledge track. So if anybody is interested, you can come over there. And maybe I'll do a technical breakout session, or maybe I'll explain a little bit more on these technologies as to like how the kernel mode injection could work. But then again, there's still the obstacle of how to exactly do it. Yeah. Oh, the last native API function? Yeah, VW set system information. And the information class we are dealing with is system load and call image. I think it is number 38, if I remember right. All right, guys. Thank you.